Start. Hi, thank you all for staying all day on such a beautiful Sunday, and I'm sure you're going to find our closing speaker to be send us off with some energy and enthusiasm and food for thought. Frederic Maigret has been teaching law at McGill for the past 3.5 years. Before that, he taught for 1.5 years at Toronto, University of Toronto, so he's relatively new to the professorial ranks and teaching ranks compared to our opening speaker, but certainly has impressed us at Teaching and Learning Services since he arrived at McGill with his enthusiasm about teaching and thoughtfulness about it, and that was really what prompted us to invite him to speak to you today. I see that many of you do have laptops. That's great, and Frederic will tell us all how to use them. So without further ado, turn it to you.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for the introduction. I'm not sure the microphone's working, but I'm sure that's taken care of. So I've had the pleasure of teaching this university for 3 years now, and you know, it's been quite an experience. I've only been teaching for about 5 years in all, and I still remember my first seminar, walk into that room with this sort of adrenaline pumping and thinking I was going to faint, you know, the first time a student asked a question, and it's gotten better since. I am a little less stressed, luckily. Well, the first thing I'd like to say is how thoroughly I've enjoyed teaching. And, of course, one of the strange things about the academic career is you never really know that you're actually going to enjoy teaching until you get a position or something like it. But we spend a lot of our time doing research, and then there's this whole dark side and of what we're supposed to do then professionally for many years that we're not always trained to do. I'm very happy to see that Teaching and Learning Services is organizing this event. I never had that chance, so I sort of improvised and learned as I went, and I've managed to accumulate a few things along the way. So one of the first things is the importance of interactivity. Okay, so of course it's me speaking to you, but I'm frankly more interested in what you have to say, what you have to contribute. The problem, as you know, is it's actually quite difficult to have a 1-on-100 conversation. And so for a while I've been looking for ways to make class more interactive. That's why I suggested that you might want to bring your laptop in class, and you can figure out today's means. It's very easy. So it's one of these tools. My test for bringing a new technology in class is, you know, does this take less than 30 seconds to understand? So I'm not very adept at these things. And today's meet is as simple as you just type in the address, and basically students can start chatting with you. It's what some of you may know as a back channel. And this can be really disruptive if you have it open throughout the class, because students will kind of, you know, do live commenting on what you're saying, and you know, every now and then you'll catch it with a corner of your eye and not know whether to stop or, you know, to take it seriously or just let it pass. So I probably won't take that chance in today's session. Well, I did want to use it to begin with, just to get a little more of a sense of what you've gathered from today's events. And the title of my presentation is Things I Wish I'd Known When I Started Teaching, and I think there's quite a few things I wish I'd known, but before I introduce those, I'd like to get a sense of what your impression after today is of what, or based on your previous experience, what your impression is of what makes really, truly great teaching. So I'd like us to take 5 minutes. Those of you who have laptops, you can type directly. Give me a few suggestions as to sort of memorable professors, instructors that you may have had, qualities that you value above all, or things that, you know, you'll come out of today with. Let's get a bit of collective brainstorming. Now, the beauty of this, I just get to sit back and let you do the work. That's the beauty of, you know, student-centered learning and participation. So I'll just sit with one of you here and wait to see what happens. So it works from your phone, that's right. No, and you can, by the way, there's lots of tools like this that are pretty cool. I think you've used iClickers today, but I use increasingly a website called, I'm probably not supposed to say what it's called, but there are websites out there that allow you to do instant polling with your students' computers. All right, so, well, this works from my phone. That's good to know. And enthusiasm would be, I think, something that we can probably agree on. I like generosity. You know, this is something that one doesn't mention that often. We tend to emphasize intellectual qualities. There's certainly probably a moral and human dimension to teaching, and I certainly remember a few of my professors dearly as just having been generous with their time, generous with their ideas, generous with their discussions. Contracts 101. Socratic hell. So maybe we like Socratic hell. You know, I found the Socratic method a bit hard to implement here. I found students were often not very ready for it, but there's ways around that. And constructive feedback is a really important one. That's a good one. I mean, I spend less and less time preparing my lectures. That's partly because I get the students to do most of the work in class. But I spend, you know, the time that I save preparing lectures, I've now reinvested in giving feedback. And that's become, now I know there's a few of my students in the room who haven't had my feedback yet, but generally I try to do a good job of this. And it is very important. Passion and passion, repetition. Yes, pourquoi pas. Making students feel validated. That's really important. And it's sometimes hard. I mean, sometimes you will get, you know, answers that are simply not that great. And somehow you just have to find it in yourself to make it look as if it's at least interesting. And you're just kind of happy that it was contributed. But it is really important. And I was trained in the French tradition. And the French tradition is a bit cassant, as we say, right? So if you give a wrong answer, you get a sort of abrupt rebuttal from your prof and you're made to feel really, really bad. And trying that in Canada, and it didn't work so well. So I think one has to be, it's very important, making students feel that somehow this was really the answer you were expecting. Yeah, treating students as colleagues is a really important one, and there's ways to do that. I increasingly have sort of student-centered teaching methods where particularly I draw on my graduate students to help me prepare class. And so I think that some of them have found that interesting, but it does treat them a little more as colleagues, and it does foster an atmosphere that's more collaborative. Yeah, it depends on what kind of humor. That sounds like it was following on something else, but yes. Okay, logical, organized, knowledgeable, and funny. Funny is always very important. What's erasing curiosity? I'm not absolutely sure. But that's probably poetic. Okay, so let me see if this works. Well, that's the trouble with technology. It never fully works when you want it to. It will in a second. The first thing I'd like to say is, there's something I wanted to do. I didn't get time to do it. I wanted to bring in a webcam, and I wanted to film you right now as I'm seeing you to give you a sense of what I see from here. And this is the first experience you'll have as an instructor, and it's really a defining one, is all of a sudden you're seeing all of these faces, and it's amazing, especially as you get more experience at this, how much you can gather. In the space of a few seconds as to who you're addressing, right? There's all kinds of things, right? Distribution across the room, little clusters, little groups, and of course, after a while, you notice people who tend to sit with certain people, people who change place in the room at each class, those who always stick to the same place, people obviously chatting, people, you know, giving you a nice sense that they may be a bit bored or it's late in the afternoon. People being really keen. So there's a lot of body language, a lot of expressions. And it's amazing. I mean, I think, of course, as you know, students don't always realize how much profs pick up. And this is one of the first things you'll notice, that, you know, that legend that the prof can see everything. It's actually true, right? So you can see, and within a few seconds, that someone is chatting with their neighbor at the back of a room, and it can be incredibly sort of disruptive and for your concentration. That's one of the little things you have to learn to deal with. It's no big deal, but you do. I think in the first months, I had to develop a certain toughness, right? You're super exposed. Everyone's looking at you. You make a mistake. Everyone notices. You make a bad joke. Awful, it's awful. You just hope they don't think you actually meant it as a joke. Sometimes they realize you were trying to be funny, and that's a little hard. I think at first I sort of sought to protect myself a little because some of this was quite scary. But then you have to learn to open up again, right? And I think for me the key lesson has been that I can't lecture in my bubble, right? And it's always a temptation, right? To prepare late at night the day before your lecture, the sort of a killer lecture, right, where you think, well, it's got everything, it's super well structured, it's super well organized, etc. And then I'll come into class, and I don't care if they're not listening, I'll sort of lecture in my bubble. And I, deep inside of me, I know this was a great lecture. And I had that temptation, to be honest, but I would really work a lot, but I would spend a lot of time in the preparation and less time actually paying attention to class dynamics because I thought, well, if all the substance is there, that's already quite something. And over time, I've realized all the substance is really not much, right? I mean, you can have perfect lectures, but if there isn't the right level of attention, it's pretty worthless. So I'm really not managing to do this full screen. Which is interesting. So I'm going to give this one last try. Okay, so I can't do full screen. But it looks pretty big, actually. Here. Sorry? Yeah, I just tried that. That's why I'm a little surprised. But okay, this is Prezi, by the way. I don't know. How many of you know Prezi? Two? Okay. So Prezi is a new presentation tool. It's not made only for universities. It's used a lot in sort of techie conferences. And thinking about tools is really thinking about pedagogy, right? So I don't fetishize these things. Some are better than others. I'm a little geekish, I confess. But it's really these tools are only as good as they allow you to teach well. Now, one of the problems is over the last years we've been, there's a particular piece of software that has invaded the teaching environments, which is sold by a big software corporation and involves little slides with bullet points and people put animations and pictures on it. And it's a hugely successful tool that comes from initially marketing and it wasn't made for universities. And I think that tool has come with lots of costs, right? PowerPoint, not to name it, okay? One of the costs is, of course, PowerPoint, is great if you're doing a presentation on your annual sales with your salesman, and you need to sort of get the facts across as quickly as possible. But if you're in the business of education, you're in the business of making people think, it sends fundamentally, the medium is the message, and here the medium is sending the wrong signal. It's sending the signal first that there's just a certain amount of stuff that needs to be known, and what's beyond the slides is beyond the syllabus, which I realize, depending on the discipline, that's something you may be okay with, but certainly in disciplines where you're trying to trigger a discussion, where you're trying to show that things are complex, it's very constraining. The other big problem with that tool is that it's very sequential, right? So it's one slide after the other, and very quickly you'll find that, I used to have like 28, 30 more sometimes slides per class. And, it would all start really well. I'd go from the first to the second, et cetera. At one point, there would be a question, or somehow my thought pattern would have changed from the moment when I did the slides, and I'd feel an irrepressible urge to jump to slide 15, right? And so how do you do that? Well, it's a bit awkward. You have to escape and then kind of, you know, and it's not great, right? Because it's, the tool's not made for that. You can't really navigate. So that's a long introduction to say Prezi is a, you only have one slide, so that's the beauty of it, and it's a zooming tool. So rather than it being sequential, you zoom in and out of what is essentially a big mind map. Okay, and so depending on the class, it'll make it much easier to discard some parts of a Prezi to explore with the students. So let's imagine we're all kind of, you know, holding a map together, and we're trying to find our way among sort of, you know, complex knowledge and arguments. People can almost literally point, say, you know, I want to go north, you know, and I want to go east, and you know, what's this bit here that you haven't shown us, etc. Okay. So, and by the way, if you can copy the link and you can do your own navigation at the same time. All right. So, what's the starting point? Well, the starting point is this, which I called every prof's worst fear. Okay. So, I do think that this is something we can't avoid. Is there has to be a certain minimal entertainment value for any knowledge to be or skills to be learned collectively, and so there's no way around that. And you know, you'll learn that there are hours that are really bad for teaching, you know, just after lunch or sometimes late in the evening, etc. So you have to adapt. You have to know it. And it doesn't mean you have to be a clown all the time, right? This, of course. But I think you have to draw in the students into the lecture, make this less passive. So to give you an example, if this place was just a little more sophisticated technologically, I'd have one screen with the bank channel where you could be sort of typing away and commenting as we went. And I think that would probably give at least a few of you, you know, an opportunity to be more involved. But there's all kinds of things one can do. Oh, wonderful. Okay. So let me first start by saying this is one of the best kept secrets, but teaching is actually the best job in the world. And obviously other, you know, people may disagree with this. But I think it's important to believe it. And I think, you know, sometimes as professionally one loses track of this. And certainly if, you know, you're teaching several hours a week, sometimes it won't feel like the most exciting job in the world. But it really potentially can be, especially, I would say, in a university context where, you know, you don't only teach, but you decide what you teach all the time. So you're making these crucial decisions about what gets to be in the syllabus and how you convey it, etc. The other thing, I think, is there's no such thing as a perfect class. Okay, so this is... you know, it's a performance art, right? So there's no, it's not like an article where you can work on your article, you know, to death until it's, at least as far as you're concerned, the best it could ever be, right? With a class, there's no class is ever alike. And you sometimes walk out of the class thinking, you know, that was great, but you won't be able to know exactly why. Sometimes feeling really down, but then run into a student who tells you he really enjoyed it, etc. So it's very much an art. And of course, the other thing is you're talking to a lot of people who may have very different expectations. So not, you know, you can't make everyone happy. That's another thing I've learned. And God knows you'll see this in your evaluations, right? For those of you who go on to teach, is, you know, well, yeah, there's always about 5%, and, you know, maybe 20% sometimes, I don't know, but it's just very unhappy. And but what makes evaluations mysterious is when you might have that 20% who, you know, write super enthusiastically about the class with you, saying it's the best they've ever had, etc. So you can't, you know, these evaluations are useful, but especially after your first year of teaching, don't let them sort of, you know, bring you down, or, you know, don't despair because they're just a little sampling of what, you know, people wrote probably quickly and perhaps not meaning all of it. Okay, so know your audience. And... really important. I didn't think this was that important. I just assume all student audiences were more or less alike, right? Just a cross sample of the student population. And I knew I've been a student myself for, you know, longer than I care to mention, so I have a sense of what it means. But I assume they were all the same, and I found that, in fact, each class is a bit like an individual, so you should treat each class on its own terms. Of course, it can be difficult to meet everyone, as, you know, if it's a class that big, There are ways. I'll give you a few tricks. I mean, okay, one of them is it's really a big group. One thing that my students love is to have, if you have a survey in advance of the class, asking them what their expectations are. Okay, so you get their email, send via mass, you know, survey using some online tool or other, and you then get a sense of what they're interested in, and you can then show them results and say, look, collectively, this is what you produced. You seem to want to explore this rather than that. You fine with, you know, student-centered teaching. We just want old-style lecture, etc. And it gets a sense. It's also nice because it's almost as if there's a contract, a tacit contract between you and your class. You know, they say, look, I'm only doing what you asked me to do. You know, if it was a survey, most of you filled it. This is, I'm giving you what you wanted. So that's quite important. There's a few other tricks. I mean, one of them, it looks like nothing, but is to stay around after class, to be one of those profs that is actually quite easy to grab and to have a chat with, or at least, you know, you may have other things to do, but at least send the signal generally that you're approachable. Very, very important. There's always a temptation to rush, and, you know, as you'll see, it's sometimes a little hard to answer questions after you've been lecturing for an hour and a half, and, you know, just want to go to your office, close the door, and, you know, relax, but this is a great moment for students to meet you and for you to know them. Of course, you should know your students because they know you. This is another intriguing thing that, you know, you walk into this room and think, well, you know, they don't know anything about me. In fact, they you know, of course, these days students, you know, will Google Facebook, you know, et cetera. They won't know that much, of course, but they'll know where you come from. They'll have certain expectations. I found that quite interesting. Some of them, like, will have read your articles, will know your stuff, and I think that's worth keeping in mind. This isn't really quite working the way it's supposed to, but okay. All right, so here's a few. This is where it gets a little more concrete. How much preparation time one puts into any class is, of course, a key issue. My first lectures ever, for an hour and a half of lecturing, I would spend the day before doing only that, you know, a good 10 hours of work. Of course, after a while, you realize you can cut this down, you know, by about 50% every year until, you know, probably, if you had no choice, you could walk into a class and, you know, give a lecture you gave a year before without, you know, any preparation. That's not great. I don't particularly recommend that. But it is a possibility. One risk, though, is over-preparation. Okay, especially in the early years, I used to prepare way too much. Okay, so the problem with that is I would produce tons of notes, and then I felt like I owed it to myself to go through all, you know, I'd put in all this work. I needed to sort of transmit this, you know, to my students. And I never did, and sometimes didn't get beyond half of what I'd planned to say. And I can tell you, I mean, it depends, of course, what discipline you're teaching. But if this is a traditional lecture, which we still do every now and then, probably for an hour and a half, you don't need more than 5 pages. It's very difficult to you know, if you have more, to keep it within an hour and a half. And I routinely had 15, so there was just no way. And the other thing is, I used to write, like, I used to script my lectures, right? This was like a dense scenario with, I'd even have the questions in there, you know, and little pretend, you know, possible answers, and because I was so scared I wouldn't know. And after a while, you let go, right? So, you know, you just, then it's little bullet points, then it's just titles, and these days I just go in with one sheet. And I found that's much more helpful. Of course, the stuff is in the back of my head. I've, you know, done the readings that I gave the students, etc. But I have, you know, my recommendation would be like 3 or 4 ideas you want to get across. You know, it's that simple. You just write them and then just let the magic of the moment and the adrenaline do the work. The other problem with notes is they will constrain you. So you'll have these moments where, you know, like I'd start reading, then I, you know, there'd be an alarm bell, you know, saying, this is awkward, you know, like no one actually speaks like this. So I would revert to normal speak for like Right, so what I really wanted to tell you is blah, blah, and then what was I going to say after that? And so I would go back to my notes, and, you know, it would just be this blurb of, you know, just too many things, and I would zoom, latch onto something. Oh, that looks good. But typically your mind, if you want to maintain eye contact, your mind can only sort of pick a word or two. So I would just go on these incredible tangents, right? Because these, I just happened to have read the wrong words, and they were, you know, oh. And so you have these things like, what the hell was I trying to say when I wrote this, right? Because your sentences are too long, and they don't make sense. And your students realize this. They're like going, So don't let your notes constrain you. Let me give you another tip. This is what defines a class is also what you leave out. So this is really the key decision. Like, I'm by nature quite encyclopedic. So I thought, you know, I'm going to teach them public international law, begging to walk out of this class knowing everything there is to, you know, a good public international lawyer should know. Okay. And so it would just be enormous, and it would end up being quite superficial. And then I realized, well, you know, overall it's better to cover far fewer things, but at least that, you know, some of the things we cover really incorporate and really understand. And so you have to make these choices, and things that, as an academic, as a scholar, may seem really important. All of a sudden you say, you know, I teach international human rights, so it's a huge course potentially, and each time I what am I going to leave out? You know, like, should I leave out the death penalty, or should I leave out, discrimination against people with HIV, or, you know, world trade and human rights, or, you know, and isn't this going to be, in this case, it's even worse because it gets political, etc. But at the end of the day, that's what you have to do. You have to, and it takes a little courage to leave things out, but your course is the better for it, right? Because otherwise it's just impossible to do. The other thing, of course, is you need to be relaxed about this, because you know that in the best of worlds, ideally, the students are, you know, not getting all their information from a class alone. So what the percentage is, I don't know, but I'd like to think that in an ideal world, the lecturer would be 30% of the big class would be 30% at most of their learning experience on a given topic, okay? Now, in practice, it may be that they don't do the reading. So 99% of what they get is from your class, but that, in a sense, is not really your problem if, you know, they don't do the readings. But I think we should operate on the assumption that there's a lot of preparatory work, and that's the only way it's feasible at university level. All right, so you've probably done discuss this today. Think of classes orchestrating learning rather than providing content. So think of yourself as a chef d'orchestre rather than, you know, the cement truck sort of bringing the substance. And that took me a while to figure out. And I really put the emphasis on knowledge rather than skills, and on what I had to say, and making sure I got right whatever I wanted to say, rather than getting them to have their own thought and learning experiences. And so I've switched, and it's taken me a long time, and it may be easier for you. I was always lectured to, always very passive, so it was a bit of a mental, you know, revolution for me. But these days I really think of my classes as a series of events, as a series of encounters, of shocks, of experiences, and you have to write a little scenario in advance, right? And it's really it's like a story, yes? Right? So I'll walk in, and then we'll have 10 minutes where I'll do an introduction, and then, you know, I'll get them to work on this for about 20 minutes. Timing is, of course, very, very important, and then I'll get this person to do a presentation on this, because it'll contrast nicely with what came just before. And, you know, so it's a kind of, it's architectural, right? There's a lot of architectural thinking that goes into building a class. So I can probably skip some of those. One thing that I got in my evaluations, okay, at one point was, well, we really didn't like that you gave all these readings and didn't draw on them in class. And if you want students not to do their readings. That's the best, you know, way to do it. If you never seem to make the readings directly relevant to class, after a while they'll think, you know, it's just pro forma, you're just giving this to them because they need to read their 50 pages. It's hard sometimes because, you know, you've got to make choices with readings and, you know, sometimes you want to talk about something else and you've moved on since you assigned the readings, etc. But it is important. Yeah, I'd like to say the whole bit about improvising, really important to let yourself be surprised by the moment. Okay, but, you know, there is this syndrome among some professors that you've got your perfectly outlined scenario of how the class is going to happen. Then after 10 minutes, long intervention by a student, asking a question that to you at least is completely unconnected to the substance of what you were supposed to talk about on that day. And there's certainly my initial reaction was, you know, and I think that the student got a sense that, you know, he asked a sort of disrupting question and I would just do everything I could to bring everything back on track, right? So that expression, that very idea of bringing things back on track, that could be part of a problem. Maybe you want to be led off the tracks, you know. After all, you know, if that's what the student wants to know and you develop a rough sense for whether a particular student is speaking only for him or herself or for, you know, for class in general. But be ready to be led away, okay? Because, you know, learning takes obscure routes. But something that you think was totally understood turns out to be totally misunderstood. Hence the importance of asking questions regularly, right? And I'm amazed by, I mean, the lecture is dying, right? The traditional lecture where you're giving most of the content, that's really disappearing fast. And one of the reasons I found is, you know, I'll lecture for 2 weeks on a given concept. And I've, you know, this is what I used to do. And I really worked on it. I did my best to be clear, to be pedagogical, etc. And then after 2 weeks, I would ask a few questions that just seemed, you know, referring to what we did only the week before. And I would get blank stares. I mean, I would, you know, and I would realize that, you know, as long as you're just passively taking notes, there's no knowing whether you've really understood something. You only start understanding and learning and memorizing when you actually have to use the material. So rather than ask for questions after you've given the lecture, say, give up the lecture, start asking for questions from the start, right? Just go straight into question mode, which is not what I'm doing really today, but this is normally what I try to do in my classes. It's just an easy one. The first 5 minutes are the most important. And the first 5 minutes are maybe the only ones where I would recommend that you script them a little, right? Even as you develop, you need a point d'entrée, a point d'attaque, right? Something to start with to get their attention, to get also their goodwill. You know, goodwill is important. You can't expect students to just listen to you, and you know this, but you know, just because you happen to be in this position. So there has to develop that kind of complicity early on, and you know whatever it takes to grab attention is good. Okay, another one. If you're relaxed, so will your classroom be. I was looking. I went on Google Image and I wrote stuck in the elevator. This is the picture I got. The impression I want to give is that. I mean, it looks like there's a lot of space, and you know we're not particularly connected. In fact, you realize after a while that we're super connected, that a nervous instructor will create nervousness within the class. A relaxed instructor will create a relaxed atmosphere, and you know there's lots of communication that's going on through body language, through eye contact, and that's super important to be aware of. And certainly, being calm and relaxed, and even if you're super scared and this is your first lecture, etc., is really quite important. Don't show that you're too nervous. I mean, students will be understanding, but it will create this tension that's then very difficult to get rid of. Okay, so, oh yeah, this is a really important one, very simple. Don't hesitate to interrupt me, by the way. One really underestimates the extent to which teaching is a physical exercise. Okay, how many of you have taught like an hour and a half lectures? Yeah, so you know, right? The feeling of being totally dead after class, needing a quick injection of coffee or chocolate or something. And that tells us something also, right? I mean, of course, it tells us that we should eat before and make sure we've got the calories to do it. But also that, you know, there's a performing element that it is really physical. And also, I think your degree of exhaustion is a testimony to your generosity in teaching. I mean, if you're not exhausted, you know, because you sat... I used to have, professors in Paris in the Sorbonne who would just read their textbooks sitting. And I can imagine they weren't exactly exhausted. They didn't particularly look exhausted afterwards. And no wonder. So it's a good sign if you're exhausted. Although you'll realize also that your body adapts. After a few years, it becomes less and less exhausting, right? So I used to be incapable of teaching twice in a day, and I'm much better at it now. Okay, full screen. Yes. Oh, that worked. Good. Okay. That's a really important one. Your students are bright, but they're also clueless. Okay. Don't mean this in a... I love my students, etc., but they are really bright. And I think my students, I'm often awed by my students, humbled by them, etc. However, I also had a tendency initially to pitch every lecture as if this was a conference presentation with colleagues, right? So I would just be at the top of my science, at the top of my, you know, the best I could do, and, you know, because I was so anxious that I would get something wrong, and I would lose them totally, because I'm just... You know, we absolutely forget how long we've been immersed in these little disciplines that we do, right? And how things that are, you know, totally obvious to us because there's layer upon layer of knowledge built upon them are just totally mysterious sometimes. And that, by the way, is something that is just realizing sometimes through more questions, etc., how little the students know, but they don't necessarily have the intuition, they don't have the instinct yet. That, in a sense, made me feel more useful. Right? But I could, okay, that's something I can do. There's a lot of y a du chemin à faire, and we can do it together, and I can be part of this. But knowing where they stand, that means you need to evaluate them early also. There's all kinds of ways you can do that. The other thing is it's okay not to know the answer. I'd say that happens to me, well, probably once a week still today. I've gotten better at dealing with that. I was asked by my dean a few years ago to teach a course I knew absolutely nothing about. And so at first I tell the students from day one, look, you know, I'm teaching Canadian criminal law, but I'm not really, you know, with any bar. I didn't study law in Canada, and I didn't study criminal law in Canada either. So you ought to know that, you know, from a start that, you know, why I'm there teaching it in the first place is, you know, it's a bit of a mystery, but I'm doing my best here, and it's okay. And I found the students gave me a bit of, you know, they understood that, oh, they're probably institutional constraints, and, you know, as soon as they saw I was putting in the hours, and I could bring, you know, the stuff I was strong on because I had a certain background, etc., it was all right. But it gave me a bit of leeway whenever, you know, I would have these really pointed technical questions on... Or, you know, students would mention cases I didn't know, that sort of thing. It's not good if it happens too often, but the worst thing, which I tried maybe once or twice, is to pretend I knew the answer. That's a high-risk strategy. It can be a bit embarrassing when it doesn't work. The other thing is... You know, these days, and I'll mention this later on, but students can get all the material on the internet. You know, there's tons out there. So, you know, the question is increasingly becoming, what's the value added of a lecture, like a physical lecture? Why, you know, what's going to, you know, drag people out of bed at, you know, 7 in the morning in the middle of a Montreal winter? And one thing I found is, you know, if it's just that the prof knows the answers, well, you know, Wikipedia probably knows a lot of the answers as well. It's more that the prof gives you is just a rare instance of seeing someone struggling with a thought process in front of you, right? Doing improvising with ideas and the kind of magic that comes from that improvisation. That's what's priceless, and that's the one thing that we can still provide. Okay? Otherwise we can have robots, otherwise we have textbooks, but you know, this ability to bring in an idea from one place and, you know, make it sort of interact with another idea and produce a third idea live, and sometimes even come up with stuff that for you is entirely new. I got some of my best academic ideas just in class, right? Just because of the pressure, the adrenaline, all of a sudden creates these conditions where, you know, ideas are being thrown at each other at colossal speeds and you have to come up with an answer. And so, you know, and your mind sometimes works wonders in these conditions. It's a great experience as an instructor. There's a really important one. Know your students' names. Okay. I don't mean it just as in. So it's not only important to know your students in general as a collectivity, but it really makes a big difference, and they'll notice it. And there's tricks, of course. So one thing I used to do is you can print the Minerva sheets, and you've got the little pictures, and so you can memorize the names before you even meet them. And if you want to really impress them, you can ask them to introduce themselves quickly and then pretend that you've, you know, remembered their 35 names. That worked really well. But just generally getting the names and getting the names right is a really valuable skill. Class participation, okay, that's always a bit of an uphill struggle. You'll find that, yeah, you know the dynamics, you know, the students don't want to be the first one to raise their hands, etc. You have the problem of, you know, the person who's always raising his or her hand and those who never do, etc. There are ways to encourage students to participate more. There's a certain reluctance initially. By the time you've broken the ice through exercises, through, you know, whatever a device, you'll find that, I think on the whole, students will be very grateful on the long term. They'll realize that they get a lot more from a class that, you know, if it's often interrupted by random questions than from a class that's just allowed to proceed totally uninterrupted. Here's something that I've been... Like, if I think of my high school profs that I really, really liked... I'm not sure what they taught me. I'm not sure I really... Some of them, I just remember they were really cool, basically. You know, they were funny, witty, etc. They were great entertainers, okay? And I think that's... certainly there's a traditional model of teaching that's uniquely focused on charisma, okay? So the great professor is the charismatic, sort of, you know, guru-like professor. And I think... That's a model that's about to become a little passé. It's great if you have that quality, etc., but it's certainly no substitute for pedagogy, and I think certainly the whole idea behind student-centered learning is as professors we have to learn, as instructors, to take second place, to not get carried away by our charisma and our, you know, appetite to, you know, wow the students, etc., from the real task... at stake, which is getting them to learn. And really getting them to learn sometimes means they have to be the stars, right? They really have to be sitting, you know, standing there, presenting their stuff to others, etc. So I think this is something that we're rediscovering. Perhaps the limits of charisma, the limits of being entertaining, it's good, it's important, it's great if you have it, but you also should be able to let go so that the class doesn't become sort of driven by your presence. And then I get there's not much time left. To what I think is really the dilemma of a moment. Okay, and I there's no underestimating, I think, the extent to which we're on the verge of absolutely major changes in teaching, in what happens in universities, etc. Now, we have... You're not too bad as a group, and, you know, I can, like, what I'll do typically is I'll walk around and I'll try to catch as many people Facebooking as possible. And you know how it is these days, you know, people will just Facebook even if you're standing behind them, you know, they'll go on typing. So, no, I don't, that's good. I'll, So, but you're graduate students, but one thing you'll find is, and you know this, there's considerable amount of distraction and potential for disruption in class. And I think that's inevitable, right? I mean, we've now spent a lot of time bringing wireless internet into classes. We're not going back on this. And we need to make the most of these changes, okay? There's no point in resisting them in, doing what I just did. So what if that student is Facebooking? I tend to think if a student is Facebooking, it's basically because I'm not focusing his or her attention enough, and it's sort of my fault. I think it's not great if they are, but I tend to blame myself. What's happening these days is there's increasingly, especially if you think of a traditional lecture, right? Like what I'm doing right now, one person, this is an hour, it's more or less sustainable, etc. That traditional lecture is slowly dying, I think, because students are simply not learning that way, right? They're just used to a high degree of interactivity. They're used to clicking. They're used to knowledge being at their fingertips. As you're talking, they're second-guessing you all the time by Googling, what you just said. And they're used to learning on their own and to having all that information at their fingertips. Now, the challenge, I think, for us as lecturers is to make the class experience a little more like their daily lived experiences of navigating knowledge, of interacting with knowledge, which is happening virtually, which is happening in ways that didn't exist only a decade ago. And I'll give you one good example is the phenomenon now on iTunes, EDU, and YouTube of lectures increasingly being available on the internet. Right? Within 10 years, this is going to take us by storm. Right? Like there's going to be hundreds, thousands of lectures by some of the best professors out there. Right? I recently saw one developed by Harvard. It was like an HBO miniseries, right, with music and professionally directed and beautiful. And I'm thinking, if my instructor is just giving me a lesser version of that, well, I might as well go to the Harvard version. It's free, and why should I get a second-class education if I can get a first-class education? So you've got to compete with that too, right? And again, it's all about, well, what's your value added? What are you bringing that even a great YouTube video can't bring? There's no obvious answer. I'm doing a fair bit of thinking about this, but I think the one thing, of course, you don't have with YouTube and with videos is you don't have a presence of other students. Okay, other students are the greatest sort of untapped resource in teaching today. Okay, we tend to think of teaching as the instructor vis-a-vis the class, so it's very vertical. But there's that whole lateral, horizontal element, right? All that talking that isn't happening, all that's happening, on MSN Messenger, that's not happening in the right way. So I think we need to channel student synergy, student conversations with students for class purposes. And it's a fantastic resource. Get the students to talk to each other. Give you another idea is, it's what I like to call, we need to occupy the laptops. Okay, right now the laptops are being used as sort of improved typewriters. They're also being used for all kinds of distractions. Rather than see the laptop and the internet as a problem, which a lot of us end up seeing, because it's just this. I'm lecturing these days to 70 laptops sometimes. I don't want to know what's happening on the other side, but it's just like physically it's a wall, right? And people could almost hide behind their screen, those who have big screens. So I want to be on their laptops, right, with technology, whether it's the a back channel, whether even if they're navigating my Prezi or my PowerPoint at a rhythm distinct from what I anticipated, that's great. But that's the challenge, I think, is using their laptops for pedagogical purposes. And if you do, it can be great. The back channel is one example. I know. Well, that's Emily. Thank you. That's true. That's only because I couldn't have two screens. So we need two screens. But today's meet and bank channels generally I've found to be very useful. It's hard to remember all the students' names. Sorry, I'm just has been delayed from the very beginning. Yes. Right. So this is what you'll have also. This is great. Great. Look, so use these things, okay? And you'll run into really interesting discoveries, and you'll get a sense of your class as a thinking whole. Even if there's 100 students and they can't possibly all raise their hands, there's a number of students who wouldn't have talked who will be quite happy to send a little message out there via a bank channel. Someone described it in a conference I went to as listening to the murmur, okay? There's the background noise, right? Everything that's happening, like people's thoughts, you know, what they're thinking about you, that, you know, they wouldn't quite tell you directly, but that they're quite happy to put up there. So these are just a few suggestions. I do think the core is, to be a successful instructor, I think, is you need to sustain your own enthusiasm. So if you're becoming bored, it's probably that you know, there's a problem. And you either need to renew the material, renew the way you teach it. But if you do manage to keep yourself entertained, I think one of the incredible things about this job is in some ways it sort of keeps you young. It's a really sort of dynamic career. So thanks a lot for your attention. Thanks.
I want to thank Frederic very much for a very engaging talk, and what I heard from it was that really is that what it's about is the learning, not about the teaching. And I think that we tend to be so nervous about our teaching that we forget that the reason that we're there to teach is so that our students learn. And I think that that's a really nice lesson, to message to go away with. In answer to the question there about the presentations being available, they will be available. Most of the slides will be posted, a lot of online resources. On the back of your program sheet that you received today, there is the website where they will be posted. Give us a day or two to start getting people's presentations in. But you can always just look at the skill sets website on McGill, and you'll have access to all of the materials from today's session. I'd like to close with just two announcements. One is you received an evaluation session for today's session, if you could give feedback. And in your emails already, you will have a link for online feedback for the day as a whole. And we really value your opinions. This is the fifth time we're offering the Learning to Teach Day. We plan to keep it going. We're evolving all the time. We hope we're improving, but we're changing and trying to respond to feedback, constructive feedback from you, so we really value your opinion. And I'd just like to thank you all for staying, and thank Frederic again for a very informative session.